Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Vijay Ramakrishnan on his article, Ergonomic Analysis of Surgical Position in Functional Endoscopic Sinus Surgery. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by Medical Center Pharmacy, leaders in topical sinus therapy for chronic sinusitis and polyp patients. Founded in 1990, MCP provides innovative formulations that combine steroid, antibiotic, and antifungal treatments. These medications are instilled directly into the sinuses using various devices. Successful insurance billing, thorough patient education, and prompt delivery are why physicians and patients trust MCP as their premier pharmacy. Please visit www.mcpnc.com or call 1-800-930-8785 for more information.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Vijay Ramakrishnan from the University of Colorado in Denver. I guess it's more technically Aurora, isn't it, Vijay?
Yes, technicality, but Denver-Aurora area. Thanks for having
me, Tim. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be discussing his article, which is currently available in Early View online, and it's entitled Ergonomic Analysis of the Surgical Position in Functional Endoscopic Surgery. Again, Vijay, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to having this discussion. It's something that many of us talk about in the hallway, but it's pretty uncommon to talk about in such an open forum. And I know when we put our collective heads together, we can make some progress in this area.
Yeah, so tell me, how'd you get, I know you do a lot of microbiome stuff and some fairly translational type research. I mean, traditionally, that's what your academic focus has been. How'd you get into this?
That's an interesting question, and I've thought about it. I don't know if I have a specific answer for that, but I recall being a medical student on my general surgery rotation and not wanting to do surgery because of how I felt at the end of the OR day. You know, as a student, you're the fourth person in line behind the attending, the senior resident, junior resident, but you're asked to do all of the heavy lifting, right? You're holding a retractor in some odd position for hours in a row, and then at the end of the day, you know, some body part hurts. And we were taught really just keep your mouth shut, suck it up, and ignore it, and you just accept that as part of the job.
Right.
And I feel like in a way that's become pervasive in surgery in general is you just deal with these sorts of issues on your own. And how this became sort of an area of interest for me was honestly when I finished fellowship and I started at my position here at Colorado, I was starting to do these long skull base cases. And early on in your career, you don't really appreciate the need for speed, I say, but they end up being 6 or 8 or 10 hour cases. And at the end of the day, it just hurts so bad, and I had to figure out kind of what else I could do to change this. And it was really a bit of fortuitous overlap with a colleague of mine who's a minimally invasive surgeon, a laparoscopic general surgeon, who came into the room one day, and he just was watching us do surgery, seeing what we were doing, you know, on some skull-based case. Later on, he started to ask me, why do you put the monitor where you put it, and what instruments do you use for these sorts of maneuvers? And I found out all these things have actually been discussed and reviewed, and guidelines been made on the minimally invasive laparoscopic surgery side, and we've just never really gotten into it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I totally agree. I've had the same experience with a colleague here. He was an orthopod who walked into my room one day and sort of said, why don't you set it up this way? And I looked at him and said, because I set it up this way. And I didn't really have a good reason for it. Also, another quick anecdote on the medical student. I remember those days very well also. And sometimes you would hold that retractor and you knew that if anything slipped or whatever, that suddenly your career was going to be submarined by the attending surgeon in the room.
One of the things that became apparent to me in learning about this is endoscopic sinus surgery, and specifically even endoscopic skull-based surgery, the differences between the minimally invasive endoscopic technique versus traditional open techniques make it actually harder for endoscopic surgery. And one of the reasons why is because you're so tense the whole time. You're not really allowed to move. You know, could you imagine operating in someone's sphenoid as you're kind of moving around, there's no way to keep the instrument still.
Right.
And as you are more tense and more still, as a medical student might be trying to hold a retractor without moving it, it really does an exponential bit of damage to the muscles you're using.
Right. So tell us a bit about how you studied this.
So this was sort of interesting because everything that we've done in otolaryngology so far has been mostly surveys. There have been a couple of big surveys in the general surgery world over the years as minimally invasive and lap colies and lap appies and that sort of thing took off about 20 years ago that suggested that that surgeons were suffering really as the patients were benefiting. And it was estimated just based on the surveys that maybe 10 or 20% of surgeons were having some physical discomfort. And in 2008, 2009, a few bigger studies came out specifically with laparoscopic or minimally invasive surgeons declaring about 87% of them had direct physical discomfort and or injury from the act of surgery. So how we got into this was some of those surveys that kind of made it into our literature. The North Carolina group did one through the ARS actually a few years ago in IFAR. And what we really wanted to do was to see if any of these simple adjustments that you could do, sitting versus standing, it was really the question in this paper, could make a difference. But also, is it actually something beyond a survey? Is there something that we could do that's measurable that can maybe add a little bit of data and a little bit of credence to this sense that we have that we feel worse? And the real reason for that, honestly, is I learned about some of these adjustments that you can make in the OR like we were talking about, and I started asking for them. We need an OR table that goes lower. Oh, yeah, you have $25,000 for that? You know, or, all right, can I get a gel mat to stand on? And people would just kind of laugh, and I would say, well, I feel terrible at the end of the day, and that could make me feel a little bit better. And, you know, the sense that, okay, it's just a surgeon complaining about something needed to be supplemented with some data.
Right.
So what we ended up doing was, this is just a cadaver dissection, because in the real-life situation, you know, in a training hospital or for us in academics, you know, we are kind of going in and out of our surgical position as the trainee, resident, or fellow steps in and out for things. So it's hard to really mimic real life, I think, in that, but we went to the cadaver lab and did surgical dissections where we did four of them kind of in the standard standing position that we use and four of them in the sitting position. And although we don't sit that often, you know, we sort of asked around and kind of practiced it a little bit. And then we followed all of the known ergonomic principles and we just tested what were the differences between those surgical procedures that we noticed on a subjective rating of our muscle fatigue. And then some objective ratings.
And tell us about the subjective and the objective.
If we look back at some of the surgeon-related injuries and surgeon fatigue surveys, there have been about five body areas and a number of specific body parts that are relevant, specifically in endoscopic surgery. So we did a survey, pre- and post-operative surveys of, you know, what's your level of muscle fatigue in these 27 areas that categorize into these five muscle groups. And then we follow that actually with a couple of other measurements. The objective measurement we wanted to use was actually a surface EMG.
Right. That's a really interesting way to kind of look at that. I'd never seen an EMG study. I was wondering if it was needles involved, and then I read it was surface EMG. Surface, is that pretty accurate?
It can be pretty accurate, and there are a number of different measurements you can take depending on what you're looking for. They all do rely on a little bit of, I would say, effort on the part of the person being measured. So what it does is you put the surface electrodes on to specific areas, and in this study we picked out four of the muscle groups that we thought we're going to present differences between sitting and standing. So the upper body we thought was going to be probably a little bit more taxed by operating in the sitting position and the lower body in the standing position. So we picked the deltoid and the trapezius muscles to monitor, and the erector spinae muscles. So those are postural muscles of the lower back. Yeah. And that was partly a personal thing because I feel like that's where I'm affected the most.
Yeah.
And then the hamstring muscles. And part of the reasons why we chose these was because they're well documented. You have places to put the electrodes. But you measure them in isometric contractions. So after the procedure, or before or after the procedure, you basically have to flex those muscles in a certain way, and then you take a measurement. Obviously, depending on how you do it, it's supposed to be a maximal flexion of the muscle, but there's some general standard deviation that's going to occur there based on the effort. This is what we found in the literature was actually one of the best non-invasive ways to get a direct objective measurement.
And the folks who were sitting, or I guess when the surgeon was sitting, you noted some findings in the upper extremities and the neck region versus in the standing position, it was more the back and the postural muscles.
Yeah, so what we did was we had one surgeon do all of the procedures just because in this sort of setting, we didn't really know what we were going to see. We wanted to eliminate variables if we could. So we had one surgeon do this on separate days, you know, trying to basically do everything the same way. What we found was something that actually mimicked the prior literature from general surgery quite well is that the eyes are strained quite a bit no matter how you do this, and the neck to some degree no matter how you do this. But we found in the standing position, there were a lot of findings, but given the small number, the statistical ones were actually the hamstrings and, in this setting, the right calf muscle.
Hmm. I wonder if that has something to do with the foot pedals, too, you know?
Yeah. So it's interesting that you mentioned that. You read my mind. So that was the first thing that I thought, because that is one of the areas that are considered within the five major topics in ergonomic guidelines for minimally invasive surgery is the use of foot pedals. And I thought how I use it is I try to never hover over the foot pedal. That's kind of the standard thing that you do as a trainee. You don't want to lose it. You think it's going to somehow make you faster to be right there, save that split second looking for the pedal. And it's actually worse for you to hover over the pedal. So I use my right foot for the pedal. And so I thought, my left calf muscle would be actually the one affected. Well, the surgeon who we were monitoring in this actually does it the other way. He uses his left foot for the pedals and stands on his right calf. So
that's what I would do.
I think that is correct, actually, your interpretation of that. In the sitting position, we noticed the upper extremities, the thumbs, left thumb specifically, in the upper extremity in the hand region and the neck were really a problem. One of the reasons why I think that is the chair we used didn't really have the adjustable armrests that people recommend for the sitting. So we had to sort of adjust the table height to allow for the ergonomic principles of the arm and elbow rather than being able to really prop it up on something.
So the elbows were not supported in the sitting position. Is that fair to say?
Correct. Yeah, the ergonomic recommendation would be you have your operating table such that your arms are a roughly 90 degree angle at the elbow.
Okay.
So it requires having your table lower than probably most of our tables go.
Right.
So if you're actually in the operating room, I haven't been able to get a table that low, or my knees keep bumping into all these random attachments underneath, and
that's my issue. Even when you reverse the table, people will say, "Well, you just have to turn the table around so that you get you're operating on the head more or less at the foot of the table. There's less stuff down there, but I still can't quite get my knees comfortably in the correct place." And I've always thought that had something to do with my height or my leg length. But David Kennedy, I think, I'm pretty sure he's still a sitter. He and I talked about your paper a couple of weeks ago, and he said, they had them sitting, but they should have had their arms supported. That's the way they should study this. So that would have been his criticism of your work.
Yeah, and I, in retrospect, I wish we would have gone to the effort to figure out how to do that. Just in our cadaver lab, we didn't have that kind of chair. And actually, coincidentally, in the OR, a lot of times it's hard for me to get that kind of chair because either other people are using it or no one knows where they are or something like that. So
they're expensive. They can be very expensive chairs, too.
I've heard that, and I know, I mean, I remember this from residency days, the otologists, you know, you're always putting those little protective armrest things on them. So I know that, that they use them a lot, and they operate when the otologists operate.
Right.
But also the laryngologists are very, at our institution, hopefully they're not listening to this, are very, I don't want to say demanding, but a word that's maybe less strong than that, that they get the specific chair with the best armrests. And I think part of
I know no laryngologists like that. I've never met one quite like that, but please go on.
I was going to say, I think part of that is this may be taught in their curriculum because there is actually at least one paper in the laryngology literature that specifies a need for specific chairs that you can rest your elbows on, and it decreases in an objective way the number of injuries that they have.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Do you sit or do you stand?
Yeah, good question. I stand. I certainly have done both over the course of my career. I felt like early in my career I really tried to sit more. I felt like more people were sitting back then, say in the late 90s, turn of the century, early 2000s. I feel like more people were maybe sitting then. And now I think it's come full circle, and I feel like most of the people that I talk with stand now, and I'm a stander for sure. I just can't get comfortable in the sitting position, even though I used to love sitting and doing ear surgery in my training.
To me, that was one of the interesting questions that comes up when I talk to people about this just in the hallway. And I feel like out of all the research that I've been a part of and the papers that I've been a part of, this is actually the one that people usually want to talk about the most. It's honestly probably one of the most important things that I've sort of delved into.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it affects everyone, you know. You can talk about the research we do on some sort of cytokine, and does it really affect everyone? This actually affects everyone.
Yeah.
And my practice is actually similar to yours, where I haven't ever been able to get comfortable sitting and operating, but I do it at times now. So that was sort of one of my, I think, final lines in here, and someone asked me this, and that's why I put it in there, is what do you do now after I think I presented this at ARS a year ago, and you know, what do you do now that you know this information? Do you do anything differently? I think I have changed a couple of things that I do. I mean, I already knew the ergonomic principles and try to set up everything as best as I can given the limitations by the staff in the OR and the hospital. But the thing that I actually changed after this was, depending on how I feel, I may sit or stand, or I may sit for part of a procedure, or there are days where I actually alternate.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a new thing for me, because I think I'm getting better at sitting and operating. But that was sort of the point of the paper, is really, no matter how you do it, you're fatiguing certain muscles.
Right.
And if you alternate, you know, you're giving one a break while you're working the other one.
You know, it makes a lot of sense. And, yeah, I remember reading that in your paper a bit and thinking about that. So what's your setup in the OR in terms of the – just tell us – Can you give us a picture of what your operating room looks like? Is the monitor straight across from you, or is it more towards the head with a slight angle?
That was one thing that I changed pretty much immediately after reading through the literature and the minimally invasive surgery guidelines. Is we sort of stand about at the patient's right, at about maybe the neck or shoulder or something, and the screen was always a little bit further cranial, you know.
Right.
So you're sort of turned to your left a little bit.
Right.
And that's actually not where it's supposed to be.
Right, right.
So I put the monitor directly across from me.
Okay,
and
okay.
We have In our dedicated rooms, we have the ceiling mounted one. So
right.
I moved the OR table around actually to have it such that the monitor is directly across from me and a couple inches below my eye level. So about 1 meter, and I learned this actually, and this is all kind of weird science that exists out there. I didn't come up with any of this stuff. But about a meter across from me, 3 to 4 feet across from you is the ideal spot for the monitor.
Okay.
So you're not, that's kind of where your eyes are actually most relaxed for focus.
And the monitor a little bit lower so that you're not extending your neck the entire case, or you're keeping your cervical spine in a more neutral position? What's the thinking behind that?
Yeah, so you would think that it's just we're human beings, and just like the angulation of the semicircular canals is such that you're always looking down. You know, maybe that's part of it, but it's actually because one of the things that makes endoscopic surgery more challenging and physically more challenging is that you're operating out of plane. For instance, if you're doing an open neck surgery and you're clamping something, you're looking right at it and your hand is moving right towards it. The way we do it is we're looking a different direction, we're moving our hand in a different direction, and we're turning the instrument in a different direction. So, I mean, there's multiple degrees of change in this concept that you're operating out of plane of your view. So it sort of makes it such that you're simplifying everything kind of is heading in the same direction.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And then when you compound that with not really moving very much and maybe hovering over a pedal or looking for a pedal, if your trunk is turned one way, one leg is rotated another way, one's holding all the weight, these are all just reasons why pain sort of develops and amplifies.
Yeah. I was talking with Jeff Sue, our colleague at UCLA, and he actually, so he has the lens clearing device pedal, and then he's got the powered instrumentation pedal. He stands on his heels, hovering one foot over one of those pedals and the other foot over the other pedal, and then he taps back and forth depending on what he needs at that moment. And this is highly efficient, and I'm all about efficiency. So I gave it a try in my operating room, and I think I was incapacitated for a few days following that particular experiment. So I don't recommend that. I don't think Jeff listens to the podcast, so he won't care. But keep that between us, but don't do the Jeff Sue technique.
I'll have to ask him about that, because that literally breaks 10 different rules
yes.
at the same time.
Yes. Yes. He's looking for a short career, I think. But
so,
boy, is that guy efficient.
That's an interesting segue into another concept of efficiency. So we tend to think that we have everything set up in such a way that's the most efficient, right? Get the patient in the room, on the table, whatever anesthesia you're going to use. Like, everything is somehow down to this science where you're shaving seconds off now.
Yeah.
And you might think, you know, in that setting, like, okay, well, we're missing a few milliseconds fumbling around looking for a pedal. If you do that a couple times during the case, let's say that adds an extra minute or two to your case, there's a very well-known concept of improved task efficiency when your ergonomic principles are maximized or ergonomics are maximized. So you could actually do a better job in a faster amount of time if everything's kind of optimized.
Right.
So the seconds you lose here and there probably are more than made up for in making one cut and having it right, you know, or being able to smoothly move around here and there. I was always very concerned about trying to make everything as quick as possible and as efficient as possible and not taking extra time to do certain things. But here I think the few extra seconds or minutes that you spend doing these things probably pay off.
Yeah, I mean, if it prolongs your career, you could think of it that way, these few seconds and minutes to set things up appropriately. I agree with you. It probably really does pay off. And it's interesting. I think you and I talked about this earlier about how we aren't taught these things during our training at all. In fact, it never even came up during my training at any point and at any level that I can think of.
Do you wear a headlight or loops for anything?
because of the way my eyes have changed, I need to wear loops if I'm doing a septoplasty incision, which I like to do without the scope, typically. So I use loops for that, but really I've abandoned headlights almost entirely. That just has to break all kinds of ergonomic rules to use a headlight on your head and to keep that on your head during a long case.
Do you take your loops off after you're done with the incision?
I do. It's not efficient at all. It's the way my eyes have changed. I'm at that age. You're not at that age yet, I don't think. I never saw myself getting there, but yes.
Well, yeah, same with headlights. I guess we're sort of blessed in a way that our cases really aren't sterile cases, so you don't have to be super detailed about, oh, did someone accidentally touch this wire or whatever, mm-hmm. but taking off a headlight if you like to use it, or taking off the loops if you like to use them, would actually be valuable. Because the focusing of your eyes in different planes and in different amounts of light, actually, I've noticed, can be pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I end up using just kind of the overhead light, and I just get my face real close in there to make the incision.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I have a pocket big enough for the endoscope,
right,
I move the light away.
Yeah, the scope's going in. Yeah. No, I hear you. I kind of do that the exact same way, it sounds.
Because they, in terms of OR equipment,
that's
always the challenge of how do we get, and that's one of the five principles that I mentioned earlier of the minimally invasive ergonomic stuff, is getting the right equipment. As you know, requesting more sinus equipment is always hard enough, but then asking for some kind of fancy chair or knee table or something, it becomes progressively more and more difficult. But these headlights that weigh less and less and less every new generation, it's almost like a new TV comes out and you have to throw your old one away and get the new one. It's great that they're light and you can take them on and off pretty quickly, but the fact that they shine this huge, hugely luminous beam of light into one spot, and you're kind of focusing your eyes in one spot and then out in the peripheral world and then back into one spot, it puts a fair amount of stress on your ciliary muscles, which we've probably never thought about since medical school.
Right.
But I've gotten away from using those for that reason, too.
Yeah, it is interesting. I feel like for the first time in my career, if I put a headlight on, I'm more likely to try to turn it down rather than to try to turn it up, which during my training, I felt like all we were trying to do is turn that thing up to 11. have we hit on all the pearls of the article and what you've learned about ergonomics? Is there any other pearl you'd pass on to the listeners?
Well, you know, the other thing that was in the article, so we used a couple of other measurements. One is actually this survey, this NASA TLX survey.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that before?
I had not heard of it.
So this is used in so many different assessments of various task completions. And it really brings out to the forefront is ergonomics has been studied for decades, probably, I don't even know, at least back to the 50s. The desk that you're probably sitting at right now has had more ergonomic study in it than what we do as surgeons. So we looked at this as a way to evaluate the amount of physical and mental demand, really, and time demand. And so for us as surgeons who stand more frequently, it wasn't actually that much more demanding. It really wasn't more demanding at all to sit and operate. It was a little bit more frustrating, we found, just probably because of that little bit of discomfort. And then our EMG findings, there's a pretty big standard deviation there, but really the thing that struck me most was in a cadaver with no bleeding and really no stress, these dissections took less than an hour.
Right.
But in many of them, we're within an hour, you're definitely feeling
you're still
a little
feeling
bit worse.
It. Yeah.
And in many of them, we did have significant changes. To me, that really stuck out was if you're actually operating on a real human being that's bleeding where there's some stress, or you have a longer procedure where you actually have to pay more attention, like a skull-based procedure, I can't even imagine how much that changes.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm sitting here thinking of all the cadaver labs that I've participated in over the years for teaching purposes. And I think my body is more physically tired at the end of one of those labs than at any other point. And I guess it's because you're interacting and teaching the whole time, but you're also going from station to station, different setups. You're probably breaking every ergonomic principle out there, and it just adds up to you even over a 3 or 4 hour cadaver dissection lab.
Yeah, and standing in a static posture really, I think, is probably the biggest thing that I've noticed. And that happens mostly in the skull-based cases where, depending on, everyone has their own way they want to set it up. And now you're coexisting with another surgeon who may be taller or shorter or prefer some other thing or have a shoulder injury they want to work around. Right. It becomes harder and harder, but you in those cases specifically, you have to stop and take a break and stretch and get some water or something. Like, I've started doing that more than I ever used to, and part of it is the acceptance that the pride in powering through it and being tough, outlasting the next person is all gone. You need to make it sustainable for yourself.
Yeah, for sure, especially in this era of the four-handed technique in skull-based surgery. I mean, there's nothing more ergonomically challenging than trying to get four hands in one nose and to do that over an extended time period.
I remember Ricardo Corral said, he's probably said this a lot over the years, but said this at his lecture at the ARS meeting last year, was just all of the minimally invasive skull-based surgery developments have, over the years, transferred the pain that the patient is saved directly onto him. And that's exactly how I feel sometimes.
Yeah. Well, listen, VJ, thanks. It's really interesting work, and I hope you continue it so we can continue to learn about this. I mean, I think it's very timely. We seem to be entering this era of wellness for clinicians and for physicians and for surgeons, and it's something that's been neglected, gosh, forever, it seems, and we're starting to have conversations around wellness, and this is part of that conversation, I think. So hope you'll continue with this work and maybe join me on the podcast again after you publish your next work.
I'd love to, Tim. Thanks a lot. It's been really fun.
Great. I've enjoyed it too, BJ. I'll see you somewhere soon. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.